if you talk to scientists and you use terms like crypto, Web3, smart contract, and these kind of words, then they're already turned off because that's not what they came for. They want to do their, they want to work in their discipline. They don't want to financialize their work necessarily. Like some of them who are already open to Web3 might be receptive, but those who are not, not.
For the journal, I had to go through this crazy thing where I had to like hoard my data for 3 years, and then it was worthwhile for it to be looked at by like, you know, 2 or 3 peer reviewers. So for me, it was more that this is very, very inefficient. And we're in, you know, the year 2021 at the time where I was thinking about this. And I was like, there's no way that this is the end all be all state of how science should be. And if it's not the end all be all state, then there's something that we should build towards.
Today, I'm speaking with Jeffrey Curry and Jonathan Heppner from Research Hub. Research Hub aims to build a platform where people can collaborate on scientific research in a more efficient way, similar to what GitHub has done for software engineering. They've also introduced a token into their project to incentivize contribution to the platform. Among many other things, we discussed transparency in the scientific publishing process, the levels of decentralization, and the problem of curation, given our contemporary tremendously high scientific output in journals and beyond. Without further ado, I hope you enjoy our conversation.
So, Jeffrey and Jonathan, thanks so much for being here today.
Hello.
Yeah, thanks
for having us.
Perhaps starting with the most basic, what is Research Hub? What's the high-level problem that your work is trying to solve?
Yeah, so maybe I can get started. So Research Hub is this kind of modernized web app. And I think that's something that's really missing in science. If you take a look at a lot of the science applications, they're all very 1990s looking and a little bit antiquated and just not modernized. So in essence, it's really this modernized platform where you can have open, free-flowing discussion. Initially, it was intended to be almost like a Reddit of science, and it's evolved much more than that. So now there's, you know, a bunch of different tools that are threaded in it, like reference managers, ability to crowdfund, different features around automating incentivized peer review. So there's this kind of idea of trying to make this all-in-one platform where you can do all of your research needs all in one place. And one of the kind of exciting parts of it is it's, you know, aspects of it are governed by the research coin holders. So there's this ability to have this modular incentive structure where the community can vote on, you know, different things around the platform. So a few exciting things that are involved in it.
And what are, I guess, the gates in terms of who can join the organization or who can join the platform and who can join the conversation? Is it only limited to academics, or what's the process of like onboarding people in general?
Yeah. So right now we tried to make it like as little activation energy to get onto the platform as possible. So really it's just a Google sign-in. So you can either use an email or a Google sign-in. And if you have an email, you can make your way to the platform and come communicate. There's no real barriers. So you can be a citizen scientist. You can be a, you know, academic. You can be, you know, somebody who is just a student, somebody who is a professor. You can all come on board. And really, we're working on threading in some things around reputation of your off-chain reputation that we think is going to be really helpful for making sure that you're accredited with the right, credentials when you first enter, as opposed to coming in with a fresh slate when you're, say, a professor who's published, you know, hundreds of papers. So for now, everybody can join. Everyone can join the conversation. And I think that's one of the strengths that we think is a strength in Research Hub, which is we're open to the crowd.
Yeah.
May I add some of my perspective here on how I see what the platform is? So
please do.
The way that I see it is like one huge forum in which you can discuss science. And then there's a lot of sub forums that basically allow you to discuss your discipline and different areas of science. And I think that's the the biggest benefit is really that you can pull scientific resources from everywhere, whether it's published on a preprint server or in a journal, and then you can share it there and then discuss the work. So it's a way to interact about science, discuss science, debate science, and find the interesting topics in your discipline. So it's really a forum to debate scientific literature. And at the same time, we have functionalities that allow you to fund new scientific research and like have a leaderboard on who are the most active users that gain the most reputation. And so it's really more than just talking about science, but I think this is the core, is really to have an open debate about the literature.
Which I guess, to Jeffrey's point, like also makes it a little Reddit-esque, I'm sure, with like important distinctions as well. But I want to ask about the two of you's respective kind of like paths to working on Research Hub itself. What got you hooked? I know Jeffrey went to do a PhD and probably spend quite a bit of time like in traditional academia, like working with the 90s websites and such. But Jonathan, about you too, like I'd be curious, what made this seem like a promising issue to work on?
Yeah, for me, it was really like a journey from being a psychologist and learning about in the psychology bachelor, learning about the replication crisis. And I had my first course called Philosophy of Psychology. And there our teacher, he taught us about the publication structure, and he taught us about the pressure to publish from his perspective as an academic experiencing these pressures. And he also shared with us that media agencies were owning the journals. And I was confused about it because I, as a naive student, had just assumed that the scientists own the journals and they decide what's being published and whatnot. And then I realized there was some third party with media interests involved. And I was shocked because I was not aware of it. And I didn't know what was the point and purpose of this. So then it turns out that this was 1 year before I learned about Bitcoin. Then the year after I learned about Bitcoin, I read the Bitcoin white paper. And I was just interested in it because it rose so much in price and I wanted to know what it was. And before I bought any Bitcoin, I wanted to understand what it was. So I learned it. And when I understood how Bitcoin worked, I was like, wait, we have to do the same to the scientific journals, because it makes no sense to me that they are owned by a third party who is not actually defending scientific interests, but maybe financial interests or public relations interests. And I was really motivated to try to get to get this done, to get to a point where we could have a decentralized journal. So I discussed the idea, but I couldn't really work on it because I was a psychology student with no programming skills and no business skills, nothing. I was just a boy who didn't know what to do with it. But I had this idea and I discussed it with some friends. And at one point, somebody told me, why do you want to just make one journal? It should really look like a Reddit for science. And I was like, yeah, you're right. I was thinking way too small. This is not, it's not supposed to be just one journal. It should be really a Reddit of science. And so I did my first steps and I just tried to do internships in this domain when I did my first internships in uni. And through that, I found Research Hub and I saw that they were building a Reddit style forum to discuss science. I was like, wait, they're making exactly what it's supposed to be. I want to work for them. I don't want to work for anybody else. So that's the way that I found out about it. I went to DeSci Amsterdam, like the first DeSci event. When DeSci finally had a name, even though the idea was already sort of in me. And then I met Pat there. I told him, Pat, you have the coolest project in decentralized science from my perspective because you're building what I think it should be. And he helped me get involved, told me to come to the community calls, and I started being involved with Research Hub and I did my first things. And later I really met the people from the foundation and I saw that they shared the same vision. They also wanted to make a Reddit for science all in their own ways. And then they found their way to Research Hub. And since then, I think I am very much like locked in to make this happen and give my best to make it possible for the world to use a Reddit style forum to debate science in real time and not 2 years after the finding has been found.
Yeah, I echo what Johnny said. So my path was a little bit different, but a little bit similar in the same regard. So I'm traditionally trained as like a neuroimmunologist. So I did my undergraduate as physiology neuroscience. I did a 2-year stint in biotech afterwards, and then did a 2-year master's where I worked on a bit of like clinical trial work, as well as some basic sciences research. And then finished my PhD doing more like wet lab focus on like translational science. So, you know, got involved with like having to deal with NIH to receive funding, which is like a painfully slow turnaround time, dealing with like publishing, even just like getting, once you've finished your paper, the simple step of like getting it sent to, screened by editors, going through the peer review process is all like really laborious and time consuming. So I've really felt the pain point like across the board with, you know, every aspect of science. And to me, it was just felt weird that I can go on, say, you know, Twitter and just upload something and make a comment about something. But for the journal, I had to go through this crazy thing where I had to like hoard my data for 3 years. And then it was worthwhile for it to be looked at by like, you know, 2 or 3 peer reviewers. So for me, it was more that this is very, very inefficient. And we're in, you know, the year 2021 at the time where I was thinking about this. And I was like, there's no way that this is the end all be all state of how science should be. And if it's not the end all be all state, then there's something that we should build towards. And so for me, the idea of Research Hub was something I'd come up with independently. And yeah, similar to Johnny, I just actually in 2021, I've been in the crypto space since 2017, actually started mining Zcash at the time. But I thought, okay, great. So there's this issue in science. There's, you know, a public ledger where like, that's what science should be, right? Like all of the content should be as public, you know, available to everyone. And I started searching and initially actually came across VitaDAO, which was one of like the kind of big projects at the time in 2021, still is. And I thought, okay, this is awesome. This is great, but I don't quite do longevity work. And then I stumbled upon Research Hub and began as a kind of core contributor, you know, early on. And then two and a half years later, have really just picked up a lot of the leadership role. Now I'm the director of the foundation. So really excited to see the evolution of the whole thing. But I think everyone's felt the pain points. And so, you know, thinking of a solution just came naturally to a lot of people.
Yeah. You kind of mentioned the history, or rather like the non-optimal state that a lot of scientific journals and like the whole publishing process itself for the sciences kind of finds itself in. Do you know how that kind of came to be roughly? And I'm asking that question because I'd be curious about the history also of similar efforts maybe in the past. Obviously now the format in which you're working on is combining blockchain and like a new idea for scientific publishing. So that may be coming together, that possibility is quite new. But have there been like other promising efforts in the past that look something like Research Hub, maybe without necessarily like the on-chain aspect of it that you're aware of? And where do you find, if there are any, that they went wrong perhaps?
Yeah, I can jump in, Johnny, but I know you're like a big history buff on this content. But I think a lot of the efforts in the past, which are wonderful efforts, are things that are will be labeled as open science. So you have, you know, really things like BioArchive that were actually quite like successful, and it took a pandemic, you know, for people to like really scale up the use of BioArchive. So a preprint server. There's been some other efforts around this. The one missing piece was really the incentive around why would somebody do this? And so we can relate this to, like, akin to like electric vehicles. There was like a push for like EVs, especially in the United States, back maybe 20 years ago or so. You can think of EVs as like a public good, right? So the public good nature of it is we want to make sure the environment doesn't get destroyed. So we want to use, everyone should use an electric vehicle. And we found that to like fail utterly. The first designs of those were like, you know, very like poorly designed. They looked kind of ugly and like nobody really wanted to use them. And I think open science was a bit like that, which is like, everyone come do this public good. And it turned out, unsurprisingly, that people a lot of time don't want to just do the public good. They need to have other incentives there to help buoy kind of their behavior. And so, you know, electric vehicles now are successful because they, you know, they drive fast. They have really cool technology under the hood. You know, you don't have to, you know, have all these maintenance costs. And so what we needed in science was those extra tools and features and things like that, to actually have all these things that make a scientist feel, okay, I need to use this. Not that I should use it, I need to use it. And the byproduct of that is kind of this open science, you know, being able to discuss and publish openly. So that should be thought of more as the byproduct of these exciting things that are happening under the hood. Just like, you know, electric vehicles have all these cool features, and really the byproduct of that is we're helping the environment because it's an electric vehicle.
So
Jonathan,
do you want to add anything to that?
Yeah. I was also thinking,
because then I'll ask a follow-up after.
Basically, what I think is, what was the case, but like, how did we end up in the situation, is because journals actually were useful at a time before the internet was as widely used as it is today, right? It made a lot of sense because it was the only opportunity for you to read what somebody else had been writing. If you went to the library and you checked out the journal section and you checked the new publications, there was no other way for you, in a way. And then the internet came around, and the people who were most comfortable with computers, they did it first. So it was the mathematicians and the computer scientists and the physicists, actually the physicists and mathematicians first, who shared their work on archive. And it turns out that in their discipline, it's already so relevant that a lot of the disciplines in physics actually rely more on archive than they rely on the journal. And the journal is like a sort of certificatory function, where it's like, hey, we certify this preprint as being really cool for publication. So it's like curated content afterwards, after it's already out in the open. And other sciences began to copy that model when the time was ripe. At first, the time wasn't ripe. We talked to the bioarchive founders, and they explained in SciCon 2023 how they tried to do something like archive very early on. But it only really took off after the Human Genomes Project, where the culture was ripe for sharing, because there was such a huge global project where scientists were collaborating. And I do think people have been trying to do this kind of like layer two on top of these archives. There are some websites that I have seen where I forgot the name, because I'm not a physicist and I don't read them on a daily basis. But in my research on this topic, I've seen them where they kind of take archive categories and they take archive papers and they upload and downvote them, so that you can find the best content on archive quicker, and you can debate with your friends and peers what the paper is really about. And Research Hub is trying to do this for every paper, and with a proper UX, with an actual profit model where it can be sustained, that can actually live on the for a long time, and actually provide this service as a layer two on top of all of the literature, to pull in different papers and evaluate them and discuss them, so that maybe when a paper is there, it's being reproduced, but you don't find the same results, so it's not replicable, then maybe the top comment can already correct the information in the post, sort of like it is on Reddit. And these abilities is what Research Hub really enables. And when you look into these other examples, they seem to exist, but not as a coherent solution that maybe for all the scientists could exist, but sort of like the individual communities kind of help themselves, and some of them are more advanced, some of them less advanced.
And in terms of the, you mentioned Research Hub being kind of like a layer two above like the literature that's actually being produced. I'm curious what your plans are or thinking is regarding the role of Research Hub in kind of relationship to the research that's just being produced as is. Like, will the natures of the world, or like the kind of like main academic journals for every discipline, kind of still be around in like that process itself of generating literature and like getting that certificate, as you said, say like Jonathan, will that still be around? And Research Hub is essentially to like actually debate it and like maybe like make the curation or like the critique of whatever is generated by the traditional processes just more efficient, essentially, and more collaborative perhaps? Or do you envision like in the future also changing the very process by which, you know, like literature is being generated, which is like a really hard issue, I'm sure, to really like tackle?
Maybe I can go first, and Jeff, you can jump in if you want to add something here. So what I think is first of all, it's of course difficult to know the future, but what I think is important here is to see what is the value of what a journal is doing, right? And then if that is being applied and supplied, that can stay around. And I think one of the values is, if you have a good editorial board, is that you actually find good literature and you actually evaluate good literature, and then people can turn to your brand for reliable information. And we have found that some of the biggest journals have big names, but they don't always live up to this expectation. And this is part of why we're having a crisis. And in some ways, Research Hub can replace this. So if we have a strong hub that is moderated by strong moderators who actually have domain expertise and they select the literature and upvote and downvote, then a lot of people are going to use that hub to find the best literature in their domain. And they're not going to turn to the journals, which does not mean that within this discipline, there might not still exist some certain journals where there's a group of experts who, like, let's say the discipline is astrophysics, but there's a couple of experts on this type of radio telescope, and they have their own journal just for radio telescopy, and this is discussed in the hub. I think this can still exist, but I wouldn't believe, like, what I think is sort of likely to happen is we can already see scientists turning to Twitter and they are trying to find real-time debate. So what I think is likely to happen is that Research Hub is going to be the main access avenue, like the front page where you go first, where you check out the information, and then you go into the different sources that are being pulled there. And that doesn't mean that they don't exist anymore. And I think they will always exist, because it really comes down to all the sub-communities. But what is really the case is that you really have to provide this editorial service, and it has to be good. And you cannot just survive based on your past history. This is it for now, but I feel like I have one more aspect in my mind that I need to think about. But Jeff, I will let you go first.
Yeah, kind of echo what Johnny said. I think one of the issues, I think the drawbacks of where we are, and we being like all of DeSci right now, is we don't have like the credibility that Nature and Science and Cell do. So what Johnny said was, I think in like the short to medium term, is I think there will be like this, you know, clustering or amalgamation of people towards like DeSci for like things that don't require credibility. So for example, for a professor, they need, you know, they're looking for tenureship, they need the credibility of Nature and Cell's publication to help get them their, you know, career goals, and then also to help get them grant funding in the future. And that's something that, you know, Research Hub or, you know, any platform in DeSci can't offer. We can't offer the credibility. Now, whether or not that transitions over time will allow us, I think, to help try to, you know, I don't want to say replace, you know, Nature, Cell and all of those reputable journals, but like help to be on par with that as an alternative, like feasible alternative, you know, publishing venue. There's things you can do. You know, we have a lab notebook where you could just go and click publish, you know, rather than have to go through this like laborious thing. And then you can have post-publication peer review. So there's things that we can offer that help speed up or accelerate the process, but we're missing that key, you know, point of being credible. So I think just like it's a little bit more credible to have like a YouTube channel, and the reach for that is a lot higher than it is now for like, you know, to go on like a news media outlet or something like that. I think that future is there too for DeSci, where it might be more credible for somebody to come publish on like Research Hub, or to come publish using, you know, DeSci nodes from DeSci Labs. And that might be the case in the future. And I think we have some track record with Web2 companies doing that to the kind of old guard. And I would imagine that something like that could happen.
The thing that I still had to think about is basically thinking about, like, I wanted to talk a little bit about my own experience as like using Reddit for my own information. The way that I did it was I would use it a lot to kind of educate myself on, like, for example, on Bitcoin. I didn't know how Bitcoin works, so I went to the Bitcoin subreddit and I went through all the resources that they had. I figured out what podcasts to listen to, what papers to read, and what wallets to use, right? All of these kind of things, I found them there. But they were all sources. They were all sourced from different websites where somebody had published their own content, right? And I believe it's going to be very similar with Research Hub, that in the end, when you discuss research, you're going to pull from different sources because you want to discuss the whole internet of possible things. And you're benefiting from all the different efforts that people make. Like the people who made the podcast, they didn't make the podcast for Reddit. They made the podcast for all of the internet. And then Reddit would link me so I could listen to that. And for me as a user, it was just always the first way of interacting with what I was looking for. And I believe that Research Hub can be a platform like this where you can interact with the scientific community. You can maybe figure out what are the most important questions in my field. Now we have a funding feature. What should I fund next with the coins that I've already earned? What questions can I answer myself? And you can have these kind of questions where when you look into, like, I was following a couple of games, for example, or even in the Bitcoin, when the Bitcoin wars between Bitcoin Cash and Bitcoin, traditional Bitcoin happened, they would debate and be like, hey, look, what are the advantages, disadvantages? And I think this is exactly what journals don't really fulfill in the same dynamic way that Research Hub can, where you can then go and be like, look, I find these findings here and these findings there, but they contradict. What do you guys think? A sense of interacting with all the possible content, and therefore not really a full replacement, but more of an integrating what exists into a different interface.
What's kind of been your experience with the top contributors to Research Hub, kind of like the curators or moderators, perhaps, that you find, you know, the scientific journals that are kind of at the top don't necessarily always have people to that quality. Like when you say Nature doesn't always live up to its reputation, it's like arguably because the curators aren't like finding and publishing the best results. How do the maybe top people like at Nature say doing that curatorial work and that critiquing work differ from the people that you've had come to Research Hub and contribute there in one shape or another?
I think actually, like my personal opinion is that Nature and Cell haven't. I think that they do actually quite a good job of curating content that does seem like high quality. If you go to Nature or Cell, you'll find like a fairly presumably what seems to be very rigorous, high quality work, impactful work. I think they actually do quite a good job of like curating it. I think the issue falls under what the scientist is willing to do to make it to those venues. That is like, they're missing a lot of like the underlying raw data that goes into it to be able to assess whether there's been like some nefarious things that are happening from the scientist's end. So, right, that's on us as the designers of this new system to make sure that we're going to include all of the possible, say, raw data that goes into everything, make everything auditable as much as possible. So that way the curators actually have kind of more data points to work with to curate the content. That's a little bit where it's not so much that those journals, well, there's other reasons why the journals are, I think, misbehaving around peer review and kind of abusing that system. But in terms of the curation of the content, I think they actually do quite a good job, but I think it's on us to adjust the system a little bit better such that we are able to pull in a lot more of that kind of raw data or information going in, and the curators are able to work with that.
I would also like to say here first, I interviewed a couple of the editors and of the hubs, and I was impressed with them. Like, people from Oxford, or I was talking to a person from the University of Zurich. He was a neuroscientist, and we had like a super nice debate. And I was very impressed with his knowledge of philosophy and the philosophy of science. This was what stuck out to me, that he's actually concerned with the epistemology of how do we make good science, and this was impressive. But I do believe that also Nature has some of the highest quality people reading and evaluating stuff. So I don't really think that the core difference is the people that we have. It's really the fact that you can write comments natively. You can not only, when I find a Nature paper, I find it probably on Google Scholar, I just download the PDF, and I'm not even in touch with the real, with the journal. I'm not on the journal website really. And so I don't see any context around it. But when I go on Research Hub, I can read a paper and there can be an inline comment in the PDF that I read on the side, which says to me, here, this passage seems a bit fishy, or this passage, you could explain that a little bit better, or whatever. These kind of comments you can find there. And there's a comment section with the top comment where if we have some of the high quality editors, they will still make mistakes. They might pull a paper that seems legit, but turns out that the data were fake. How should they know that the guy who wrote the paper faked the data? They cannot really see that. But there might be somebody else who did similar experiments now, and he can comment that and be like, this doesn't seem right to me, because when I do the same experiment, it doesn't seem at all like this. And I feel like this is where really the differences and the advantages in the software, in the UX that you have in interacting with the science, rather than in the people, because people make mistakes, and there will always be somebody who wants to game the system to get the scientific reputation that they don't deserve for, or just to have a proper salary at the university. I don't know why they do it. It seems to be, it's counterintuitive. Instead of faking data, why don't you just make a real study? You can actually find something out. It's going to be double as good. But these people apparently exist, and the problems exist. So what I believe the answer to that is really to rely on the wisdom of the crowd, to more efficiently share information and share negative results and comment your negative results under a paper immediately, right? That's maybe one of the easiest way to publish them. And I think that kind of debate makes all the difference here.
Yeah, just to build on that a little bit more, we see what we see often is we have this big kind of push towards incentivizing peer review on the platform. And we have some pretty high quality peer reviews rolling in. And it's what's really exciting to see is it seems so simple, but the simple fact that a peer review can come in, we have kind of a rating system. They can put a kind of amount of stars, almost like an Amazon review. But then you could have the editor comment underneath that and say, hey, you didn't make any commentary on figure 3B, and it's missing this thing. Would you mind putting some comment there? And then they can go back and edit their content. And that's it seems simple, but it's not something that exists now. And if you think about it, in the current system, these arbiters, the editors are and the reviewers are the arbiter of truth on the publication, right? So somebody spends 5 years of their life putting together this beautiful large body of work, and then you have three people who you don't know who they are. You can't have public discourse back and forth with them. They can be doing something that's really egregious, and it's all happening behind closed doors. And that's not right, because if they're doing something egregious, they should be called out for, the behaviors that they're doing. And, and no matter how much people think that when you have a PhD, you are the leading expert in that area, it's not the case. You're the leading expert in this really tiny niche, but a paper isn't going to fit verbatim, your experiences. And so there's going to be aspects of that paper that you're not an expert in. So when you go to review it, one thing that we do at Research Hub is when you're reviewing a paper, we emphasize this section on what areas are you deficient in as a reviewer? Because the public needs the context of the person that's making this statement is not an expert in this aspect, but they're an expert in another aspect. And other parts of the platform we find are exciting, like the kind of building out the profile of the user, right? Like right now, it's like, there's it's all fragmented. So to be able to click and see, okay, my reviewer, let me see what their publications have been. Let me see some of the peer reviews they've done in the past. It gives you more color and context around the individual. So that's just something that I think, like Johnny mentioned, the UX, it seems simple, but it's unfortunate that such a simple solution doesn't already exist in the world right now. In the journals. So yeah, we're just really excited to keep adding features around things that give more context and color to the community to help allow the wisdom of the crowd to come in and help curate.
I want to say something here about simplicity, because in actuality, it's the hardest to do the simplest things, right? Like some of the best designs are the simplest designs, but that's the hardest. Or Einstein's theory is good because it's simpler than other theories, right? I mean, I don't want to go now into Einstein. It will distract us for a long time. But the point is, simple design, for example, the iPhone is very simple design, but that makes it such a beautiful piece of technology because it is simple. And that is actually hard. And I think the same is true here, that we are making simple fixes, but they are not really simple to come up with. It's not simple to create the beautiful experience around it. And it's even still hard for us. And a lot of the work that we're doing is to improve this on a really on a daily basis. And that is what I think is, this is why it's not existent, because it's actually hard to do the simple thing.
Yeah. And would you, what would maybe, to play devil's advocate for a second, be the strong case for actually keeping? Because as I understand it, it's very much like the commentator, editor on Research Hub would kind of be a person that is like publicly viewable as like, you know, who is this identity? You know, it's like pretty out in the open, what field they work in and such. I don't know whether you allow for pseudonyms, for example, but what's maybe the strong case against public reviewing of certain work?
Try to like steelman the case. First of all, in fact, we do allow pseudonyms. So that's one way of working around this. But let's steelman the case for why we should have basically non-open identities, okay? So really one way to say it, see it is that if you don't attach your identity to this peer review, then you're more free to say whatever you want, because it cannot be tied to you and have a negative consequence on you no matter what you say. And I think that is one of the reasons why it was anonymous. And then I think the next part is that it's just like part of the scientific ethos is like the blinding of experimental conditions. So you want to not share whose work you are reading. And that's another way, that's another important thing, that you shouldn't know who wrote the work, right? Because you might already disagree with that person on personal grounds, and you might not take the argument serious because you don't like them, or because you had a debate before and you want to be right. These kind of problems exist. So that's one of the reasons why blinding exists, so that you don't know whose work you're reading. So you're just reading the work for the paper itself. A lot of this has been already undone by the preprint servers. So a lot of times you can unblind the paper that you're reading by finding it on the preprint server. And there's another way to like push back against this, which I heard from a meta scientist here in Leiden. Ludo Waldmann is kind of famous in the meta science community for his work in peer review and preprints. And so he told me that he thinks the peer review could be part of the normal conversation, just like it is in a scientific conference. And that I think is a good case for unblinding. It's like, yeah, when you're in a conference, you're literally sitting face to face. Now, where's the problem here? What is you have to have a debate. And this is also how it, all the way going back to philosophy, how it was. Socrates stood there with his own body, and the same did Gorgias when they were debating it. And then Socrates embarrassed Gorgias, right? This is how it works. But this is what debate is. And so that's the counter argument to this. Like, yeah, if we debate for real in conferences, then why do we not also debate for real in papers? So yeah, on the one hand, maybe it biases you. On the other hand, maybe that's the necessity of a conversation, and you have to see through that and be able to engage with the argument nonetheless and point out ad hominems and point out biases that don't exist, right? If I talk to somebody and they dislike what I say and they don't engage with the argument, then I will point it out and be like, no, that's not valid. You should attack it on argumentative grounds and explain what is really wrong with this, not just say that I as a person can't be trusted because you saw me speed my car or whatever. That has nothing to do with my knowledge of philosophy or my knowledge of psychology.
Jeffrey, do you want to add to that?
No, I think that was very well put by Johnny. And yeah, I did nothing to add to that at all. I think Johnny did a very wonderful job of describing that.
I suppose a few more questions that are more related to Research Hub as an organization. Between you and the people that you work with or are closest to, what's maybe the most contentious theme that keeps on repeating itself when you're debating how Research Hub should be ran, where you want to work toward Essentially, what's your main disagreement? And it's good that we have two of you here right now.
Yeah, I can hop in. And I think this is, so by nature, the design of like a research hub as an organization, it's like two pronged. So there's the Research Hub Foundation, and then there's the Research Hub Inc. team. And so the foundation, I think one thing where there's a little bit of disagreement on is like how, say, how Web3 we would like to make it. And so right now we're in this like kind of limbo phase where it's like a Web 2.5 platform. We want to make sure that users can actually come and use it. Scientists are not the most, you know, outside of somebody who is like, say, maybe like a computational biologist who is like a little bit more savvy with computers. Generally, like a lot of like biomedical science or wet lab people are not. And so to have like them come up with like spinning up a wallet and doing all these actions on chain. And, you know, at the time Research Hub was created, there was no layer twos really that were like at scale. So economically, it was just unfeasible to do a lot of like actions on chain. So we opted for like a Web 2.5 perspective. And I think a lot of, you know, like internal kind of communication goes around, you know, should we layer in some like ability to put things on IPFS right now? Should we, you know, make some of the actions or behaviors or say bounties on the platform? Should that be like an on-chain behavior? And I think that they are very important things that need to get implemented, so long as they aren't barriers to entry for new participants. And I think what people are going to come across and what I didn't appreciate until going through this whole, you know, process over the last 2 years is it's incredibly hard to get product market fit. Like it is, you know, it depends on the nature of the platform. You know, if you're just working on funding and you just need to get a handful of people to come in and fund something, that's one thing. But if you have a platform kind of like what we're working with, or you need some, you know, high throughput content or communication coming in and getting a network effect built out around that, it's incredibly hard. So any little thing that is like a barrier to being able to do that, I think is in the long run very, very like, will make it very difficult for the sustainability of that product. And so I think where we're going right now is, yeah, we know that things are a bit Web 2.5. We're definitely going to make sure to get a large network effect of people that is easy to use the platform. And then I think we can Web3-ify it over time. And so that's a bit, a little, some people, you know, are back and forth about that concept internally.
I would echo this here, what Jeff says, and kind of say how it relates to my personal like conflict here. It relates right back to the anonymity, because one of my main concerns when I started this out before I knew about Research Hub and I just wanted to make a decentralized journal was really to keep it as decentralized as possible, right? It was like a kind of Bitcoin maxi-ist version of like really decentralized as possible. And really hardcore, make sure that everybody can say whatever they want. And then you have a consensus mechanism to show what is part of the consensus and what is not, right? So that people could maybe talk about scientific topics that they can now not talk about. There's like research into telepathy. And I don't know if it's sound or not, but I know it's not being discussed in universities. And then I encountered it in books, right? And I was like, okay, wait, so people did research it? I didn't even know that. So that's a bit of a thing that I feel like maybe we could have a more public forum where you can say whatever, and then you could say that as a scientist and not risk your career and be taken as like completely out of the thing. Might still be wrong, but I think it should be debated, right? So that's one of the problems here that is still manning the case for why it should be anonymous. But at the same time, though, I see exactly what Jeff is saying, which is the UX, and this is kind of how I turned around when I realized it should be a Reddit of science. It's like, no, actually, that's more important. It's more important to provide value right now, and nobody really cares that much to have the full free speech, because exactly like it is in real life, you still have to stand face to face and debate it. So it's not really about that so much. It's really about the making a better UX, and that, I think that's where I came to stand after really engaging with this topic, and why I put my energy into that. And I think another issue, though, is very related to this Web3 and versus Web 2 idea, which is now that we have Research Hub and it's a working product and we gain some attention also from crypto speculators who are interested in the token that exists around the project. And that creates another conflict where we are often debating in how far do we embrace that and also nurture and make content for our investors, and in how far is this going to be a conflict with what scientists want to learn from Research Hub. Because if you talk to scientists and you use terms like crypto, Web3, smart contract, and these kind of words, then they're already turned off because that's not what they came for. They want to do their, they want to work in their discipline. They don't want to financialize their work necessarily. Like some of them who are already open to Web3 might be receptive, but those who are not, not. And now that's a, that creates a conflict where we're like, okay, how far can we do it? How far can we not do it? And yeah, I think that's a tough question that is actually difficult to find the right balance here to between explaining to the scientists that we are really serious about improving the scientific literature by making it easier to engage with all kinds of literature and debating it and just improve the UX of how you read and write and debate. And then at the same time, explain that there's a Web3 aspect where actually investors can partake and they should partake because in fact, that helps the science. We see that actually when the price of the token increases, this also drives new users to the platform. And this also allows us to do more serious scientific work, like fund new science with the value of the token that, that users have earned and incentivize peer reviews and all the other use cases that we are still going to invent in the future even. So I think it's a great contribution and a great opportunity, and we have to engage them too. And I can see though that we are struggling with this because it's not a straightforward thing to do to navigate this landscape and the personality that you want to portray also to the public.
I think it's going to be I think it's going to be a little bit of a shocker to a lot of projects how to like square open and permissionlessness with like maintaining like rigor and quality. It's like an unfortunate like dichotomy that exists, and I think that where you place finance or incentives, there's going to be like orders of magnitude more like bots and spammers, and like coming up with that's actually why I'm actually quite excited about like the zero knowledge identity things. I know Shadi from Holonym is working on a tool there, but being able to verify someone's personhood is actually like becoming a very important thing for us, and being able to mediate and figure out, you know, who's, because even just figuring out, even just having like an academic email does not cut it anymore. And so I think that's something that I'm sure the legacy system has already had to deal with for quite some time. Even like solutions like Orchid are not bulletproof. We've come across a lot of, you know, spammers making their way through that. And so I think that's one thing that I would just maybe put out to the rest of the like DeSci community is just be very cognizant of this like large flow of say bots and spammers that are coming in, and figure out solutions around that.
Also, this relates exactly to one of the, like, this is sort of the core problem for making a permissionless system in science, right? Especially as soon as I had this idea, some people were like, but how are you going to make sure that not everybody says whatever they want and it's going to count as science, right? That's not what we want. And this is what the journals are currently fulfilling for us. So really the challenge is around how do you moderate, right? And that's the core challenge here to create a culture on the platform where high quality content is being filtered to the top and low quality content is being downvoted, and really make sure that we see high quality science emerge from that. And in order to do this, you really have to it's you have to have technical solution, but you also have to have the cultural alignment on bringing forward the highest quality science. And that is really what the journals have been doing by creating strong editorial boards. And it seems like some of them have lost that culture to some degree. And this is why we as young scientists were frustrated. Like, I don't want to criticize because I did, like, personally, but it's just that this has happened because I ended up reading a lot of papers where I felt uncomfortable with what I was. I was like, this is useless. I just wasted 2 hours of my time. And then I only, after I grew up and I realized that papers are not really the best way to do it, and I learned that books were the better alternative because somebody had already filtered, then I learned to identify good things. And I feel like this is something that we can create a culture like this on Research Hub, where it's where good papers are promoted and where people help each other out to get quicker to this level. Because somehow my university teachers didn't tell me, it's like, look, you should read books. They were actually telling us to read more papers. I don't understand why. That is like, there's nothing wrong with papers, but you have to come to a level where this makes sense. And I feel like that is not very well communicated in the current times. And that was frustrating because of the over-focus, right? These people who were telling me not to read books, they didn't tell me not to read books, but these people were in the system being publishing and buying into the same story. And that's why they never challenged that and were never maybe aware that maybe there's another way to do it. That's what I felt was happening to my teachers. And then they were passing it down to me. And I think that's what I mean by the culture has been sort of lost. What I did, and I learned about philosophy, I turned to older sources. I started reading books from around 1900. I started reading Kant and Hegel, and then I would be, when I learned physics, I didn't read a book from today about general relativity. I read the book from Moritz Schlick about which Einstein said, this is the best explanation that I have seen so far, right? And that helped me get it. That helped me explain it in simple terms. And I realized, oh, wait, back then they had a different game. They had a different game. And that culture, I think, is what motivates me today to bring that, like, bring that back to 2024. And it's going to be it is already epic. That's the feeling that I have working in Research Hub with my colleagues, with Jeff, with Ricardo, with Pat, with Tyler, like people who actually want to push the level of science. And they are the Einsteins of 2024, the Moritz Schlicks of 2024, the people who I can trust with their actual attitude.
So would you say that, like, when you're looking at early 1900s research, for example, was the very format of that, like, was it just more accessible the way that it's written? Were there more books, in your opinion, than papers itself? Because I suppose, like, the case for papers is, like, to be on the frontier, right? To, like, see, like, how the field is, like, evolving in real time, which real time obviously is, like, problematic because, as you said, like, earlier, Jeffrey, too, it can sometimes take, like, you know, months and years, more likely years probably, to actually, like, get something out. Whereas I do think, like, a book is probably, like, even a longer term kind of project. So by the time it's, like, published, it's already, like, so much has come out, at least, like, in a very, like, rapidly advancing field. So I guess that's, like, the case for papers is more like, it's like a, you know, not quite memo, unfortunately, because it's not that quick of a process, but it does, like, allow you as, like, a working scientist or so to stay on the frontiers of knowledge in that particular field.
I'm not sure if there were more papers or more books, but what I realized that in my bachelor, they were giving us books, but those were just like, how do you call those books that you get in school? They have a certain name.
Textbooks?
Textbooks, exactly. They were textbooks, right? And then when you read Moritz Schlick's Space and Time and Contemporary Physics, that's just an explanation of Einstein's one paper, and it's a book that is like 100 pages, 150 pages, and then you get it. You're like, okay, now I can understand Einstein's general relativity. Great. It took me maybe 2 or 3 times to read the same book, but I get it now. And that's very powerful. And I feel like in the textbooks, they highlight the key findings, but in a way, what is missing is this kind of, like, when I read books now, Like I would maybe read Kahneman's Thinking Fast, Thinking Slow, right? And we don't really read books. It's just like we go through some of the key findings and in the bachelor already. So they kind of give you what a cutting edge scientist is supposed to be doing, which is they have to read papers where the books don't exist yet, right? Schlick had to read Einstein's paper to write the book. But me as a newcomer, I need to read the book rather than the paper. And I feel like they teach us to mirror what a scientist is doing at the cutting edge before we are that. And then we never turn into that because we actually ended up going the wrong way, like jumping a couple of steps and then just acting like a scientist. And then we end up having replication crisis. And Feynman called that the cargo cult science, right? It has the form of science, but not the content. And that's exactly what it is. People put the names and the numbers and they put a bunch of p-values and statistics around it, and then it's wrapped in scientific form, but it actually lacks the content because they didn't go through the actual steps to be at the edge.
Well, one concept I think like almost like a modernized version of all of this that we've actually talked about quite a bit internally is this idea of what's called like a perpetual review. So, you know, right, a lot of review papers come out and sometimes review papers are citing other review papers and, you know, you have like a lot of redundancy that's happening, but also like there's nothing that comes out like in real time that's like aggregating all of the content, right? Some new thing comes up and it usually takes like some time because it has to get published. So this idea of having this like, you could think of it as like a living document of like a giant Word doc where it's almost like it's like the textbook. But rather than editions of the textbook coming out every year or two, and it takes time to amalgamate everything, it's actually just like almost like a GitHub pull request. You know, you can just like the, hey, we need to modify this sentence with the most updated, you know, content that came out from this publication. And you have this like living doc that's just this huge review, but it's in real time. And I think that would be really helpful in all of the subsequent disciplines. So something, it's like almost like a modernized take on the textbook.
Can you, lastly, perhaps, to kind of open up the floor to you and any particular things you want to address that you feel like haven't been, are there important questions, topics that I have not asked you about today? Is there anything that you'd like to kind of get to before we close?
Really, I think Johnny and I really want to highlight culture, I think, is very important. And I think that's something that like the kind of Web3 DeSci community does really well. Like, a very strong sense of culture. That's what like rallies the community behind it. And I think that's also what's lacking in the traditional system. In fact, I think culture is what pushes people away from like pursuing like an academic career. You know, it's very feels very like cutthroat. There's a lot of like, yeah, antiquated, slow moving things. People feel like, you know, sometimes they're not allowed to say what they're working on for fear of being scooped. There's all these things where like the culture is like a very, you know, hierarchical, like I am, you know, this like amazing scientist and you are like this, you know, lowly grad student. And so please, you know, like, you know, whatever you say goes in one ear out the other. And so that's something that we would like, you know, the culture at Research Hub is like, we want to keep this like very, very exciting, very like positive, like we're all a bit of visionaries like individually. And so we want to just push like everyone's working together to like get this vision out there, you know, to the world and like actually be used by people. So we have this like very and it's part of why I really enjoy working with so many of the colleagues at Research Hub and Foundation is like everyone has this vision, but we're also pragmaticists about it. And so it's just something that I think as a kind of DeSci community, we should help, you know, continue to bolster because the culture around this is actually really, especially in these early days, what gets people out of bed. Just wanted to say that, yeah, at least at the foundation side, like I'm very, very like happy to work with like everybody that's been there along the way, because I think that's what, you know, gets me up every morning to work with all these people who have the same vision as I do.
Echo, and this is like, if you are an Einstein out there, looking to improve the quality of scientific discourse in the world and the publishing in the world, then definitely join our foundation and help us grow this vision, build this vision, improve the thing, because when even Research Hub is a software product, so it's going to be always alive, always living, always improving, just like any other software is. And yeah, we need the smartest minds to create really a new infrastructure and really be the rebel scientists of 2024. So that's that being said about the culture, I think one thing that I would have also liked, like if you like what would have liked to talk is, if you would have asked how has Research Hub evolved since you joined it, you know, I would have loved to talk about that, because that was something that was really impressive for me. I only joined them last, like I met them at DSI Amsterdam, but then I was sort of still adjacent because I had to finish my degree at university. So I was only going to the community course, but not doing a lot of work. And then I joined them really on a permanent basis kind of in May. And what I saw there was an insane growth, and that was really exciting to me. And I felt like sharing it, which is, I started, and then we had these weekly community calls. I think I missed my first one, and when I first joined, and I was still getting set up. And then the second month I came, and we had a certain amount of users, and I saw it had already grown from the months before. And then it had grown again, and it had grown again, and it had grown again, and every month it was growing, and I was like, wow, this feels epic. I'm actually part of something bigger, where I could really sense that there is a need out there that is being met, and there's more people flooding into the Research Hub community. And at the same time, I could see how also my team was growing, the people who were working with me directly were growing, and I could then find out that basically the token was recognized by people on Twitter, and then the value of the project was growing, and that drove more growth and in more users. And what I could see is that the platform actually kept improving also from month to month. Every, like when I first came, I wasn't using it a lot. Then new users came, and now I'm using it to answer my own questions. I'm debating stuff that I find interesting about physics theories that I'm not an expert in, so I'm a philosopher and I'm interested in all sciences, but I don't have the detailed knowledge in all sciences, so I ask questions to people who have the details. And really, me being able to use the platform more, interact more, and have more fun debating and really see the team deliver every month and improve the platform, that was pretty impressive and very, made me feel very energized from all the, like the growth that you feel when you put in energy and you see the results. That is, I think, something that I would have loved to see. And I feel it's also very encouraging for all the newcomers and all the early adopters of Research Hub to see that we are growing and to keep putting out the good, high-quality content on the platform and keep sharing it with your colleagues, keep sharing it and make more of good post, right? That's kind of what I see is going to be driving the success of the community, is really the content that we make.
Echo Johnny, just maybe a couple things that I hadn't, might get it got me excited, you know, when I took a look at some of the numbers. So we little bit of a self shill here, but we've about 10x'd our users over the last few months, which is really exciting. And we also, something that I feel very passionate about from the foundation side is this initiative that we have around peer review. Currently at the current pace and extrapolated out for the year, we'll have done probably about 1,000 peer reviews happening on the platform for the year, which is I get excited because it feels like that's a real dent in the world of peer review and publishing. And the average pace of the peer reviews happening after we set bounties on them is about 14 days, which is significantly quicker than what's happening in the traditional world. So if any of those things are passionate to anyone out there and you feel like you want to be kind of part of the whole process and help refine it and, you know, put it out there into the world, hop in. You can join our Discord. You can go on researchhub.com to get engaged. And we'll make sure that you have a kind of a home or a place to settle into and get involved. So thank you, Leah. This was a really awesome.
Thank you both so much.
Also, one more thing that makes my heart warm when Jeffrey just mentioned the peer review initiative. And we talked so high level that we didn't really get into all the details, but I feel Like, this is really something that is so makes my heart warm, because I could see recently on Twitter there was this survey from the DeSci Foundation around like DeSci Labs, and they were asking scientists what are the major problems, and they put at number one they put unpaid peer review, and the fact that the Research Hub Foundation can now pay people for doing peer reviews and that people are using that on a constant basis, to the fact that we have so many that we can project about 1,000 at the end of the year. That is really something that makes me so happy, because we're actually solving a real issue that academics are having right now. And when they talk to them and they tell me, this is like Research Hub really values our time. And I'm really happy to actually make an impact in real people's lives with the product that I am working on and helping on.
Sweet. And we'll link to everything in terms of the foundation and the platform below. Yeah. And also you guys' Twitters, so that people can reach out.
By the way, you should also link to the Space and Time in Contemporary Physics book by Moritz Schlick. It's like a genius book. If you don't know general relativity yet, read that a couple of times. It's very enlightening.
I'll make sure we'll link that too. Perfect. The most important of all links. Sweet. Thank you so much, guys.
Yeah, thank you for having us.